Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order this morning for an informational meeting on energy efficiency and Oregon building codes. Thank you to the committee members that are here this morning.
I'll help you out as much as I can. I appreciate it.
We're just going to start off with Representative Ken Helm.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for coming this morning for this informational session. I'm bringing the issue of modernizing our building codes and keeping up with federal standards before you, because there's a lot of exciting things happening in the world of energy efficiency, high-performance homes, passive homes, and wanted to catch the committee up on where those efforts are. We've heard a little bit recently about the cross-laminated timber opportunities that are just starting in the state, and we're going to have in the near future a building that is constructed with that product in Portland. And it really opens up an exciting new era for wood products and the type of other infrastructure that we can provide that makes the homes we build in the state efficient. And that doesn't just help your average home buyer, but it has the potential to help folks that are looking for affordable housing and renters by lowering their utility bills. I come at this from my day job as a land use attorney. I deal in zoning and building issues all the time. And code compliance ends up being kind of left out of the conversation a lot. But it is a tremendously powerful tool for increasing energy efficiency in our state. So a team of us have come together to bring you this information today. I'm going to start out with David Heslam, the executive director of Earth Advantage, and he's rounded up some other smart people in the field: Jim Edelson, Mike O'Neill, and we're going to have Mark Long, the administrator of the Building Codes Division, also talk to you today. And I'll let David introduce the other people as the presentation goes along. And once again, thank you for being here and listening to us.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Good morning. Welcome.
And thank you, Chairman Holvey and other members of the committee. My name is David Heslam. I'm the executive director at Earth Advantage. We're a 501c3 nonprofit based in Portland, but we work with builders and developers across the state of Oregon, helping them build above code homes, multifamily buildings, and small commercial buildings. And I'm glad that Ken used the word exciting this morning when talking about building codes. Those words usually aren't used in conjunction with one another. And I'm glad to see folks, coming to the early morning session to learn a little bit more about where things stand with building codes in the state. So I'll have Jim Edelson join me in a minute, but I guess first I would just like to set the stage for where Oregon sits in energy codes. I provided a handout here, and on the graph on the front page shows you that Oregon has a long history of being a national leader in establishing energy codes. In fact, we were one of the very first states to develop energy codes, and we had energy codes that were ahead of the national energy codes before there were national energy codes that were developed. In fact, that's one of the reasons that Oregon developed a reputation as being a place for innovation in building, especially around energy efficiency, water conservation, resource efficiency. That's what drove the creation of a green building program like Earth Advantage, or one that subsequently developed after that, the U.S. Green Building Council, which was largely informed by Earth Advantage. And what's driven today, we have the highest adoption rates of some of the very highest levels of performance in housing, passive house standards, which you might have heard about. Oregon is a leader in that front nationally and internationally. Zero energy ready homes, which are taking buildings to the high maximum level of energy efficiency, so then they can just be powered by on-site solar power. And part of the reason we've become such a leader in that is we took an early lead on energy codes, and that built a reputation for this area that drew people here who wanted to build highly efficient buildings. Personally, I was one of those people. I moved here over 20 years ago as a young man. I lived in Washington, D.C. at the time. Don't hold that against me. I was trying to do good work there. And I said, what I really want to do is go build really efficient buildings somewhere. And without any equivocation, everyone I talked to in Washington, D.C. said, you should move to Oregon. If what you want to do, building the most efficient buildings possible, if you can do it anywhere, you can do it in Oregon. So I moved to Oregon. I had never been west of the Mississippi on land, I think. But I moved to Oregon, sight unseen, started working for a framer, moving lumber around on job sites, just so I could learn what it meant to build efficient homes. And I built my way up, so I was a contractor for 15 years, and I got to build the first net zero project in Oregon about 13 years ago. But I wasn't the only person that moved here because of that. For over 20 years, people have been moving here because they thought, if we're going to build this type of construction, the place that we're going to do it is going to be in Oregon. This is one of the leading places anywhere that you can come do this kind of work. The reason I'm here today is, you know, at the moment, our building codes are no longer leading the way. I was just at a conference last week of state energy officials from across the country, and I learned that, you know, by later this year, Alabama will have stricter commercial building codes than we will. Alabama didn't have an energy code until, I think, 2012. There's a lot of other examples I could bring up around that, but what seems to be at issue is we've lost sight, in my mind, of what our real end goals are, and that's one of the reasons I put that graph together there in front of you, that a lot of the work in the past hasn't been about trying to keep up with a national standard. We used to think national standards were just, you know, some Johnny-come-lately kind of standard. We used to have, there were goals about where we wanted to go. And as recently as Senate Bill 79's work, almost a decade ago now, the goal was clearly set that we should be considering by the year 2030, our new construction should be hitting levels that are supplying a zero energy ready, zero energy, a zero carbon type of performance. That's what was needed to happen to align with climate goals, and that was feasible given the trajectory of cost-effective improvements in buildings. And we've been seeing that, and I think you'll hear a testimony. We were lucky enough to have a great builder here today, Mike O'Neill from Solair. He can talk to you about his personal experience with the trajectory of how cost-effective improvements have been. But right now, we could debate about whether or not we've fallen behind a federal standard or maybe we're a little ahead of a federal standard. You know, those kind of debates are better left to statisticians like I used to be 20 some odd years ago about exactly where you fall. In my mind, the bigger question is, do we want to just try to keep up with some national standard, which, as you can see, plateaus there far below the level of where we ever need to get to meet our climate goals, or what is even below the level of cost effectiveness. Instead, we should be targeting that much higher level and working with our builders like we do every day on figuring out the most cost-effective ways of getting to that level of performance. And as you, what I indicated there is our neighboring states, California and Washington, they've already taken that action. They put in place very firm visions with numbers and dates next to them and said, by this date, we need to have buildings that will perform at this level. And then it's the job of building codes to just help guide the builders get there and give the builders and developers and architects and everyone else in the real estate industry clear guidance that this is where we're headed. And everyone else can then work with you to figure out the most logical, cost-effective ways of getting to that level of performance. We struck out to do that, I believe, with the Senate Bill 79 work almost a decade ago, but we didn't get quite a strong enough mandate put in place. And I really think that, what we need to do is, set that vision in place at the legislative level so that we can inform the marketplace. Now, there's a bunch more numbers in here that actually tell you this is a really massive opportunity from a climate standpoint. The amount of savings that you're going to get is huge, because if no one's noticed, people are still moving here to Oregon, not just because they want to be green builders, but for a lot of different reasons. And just looking at just projecting off historic population growth, you know, we need to add another 20,000 housing units a year. And if you look at that over the next 35 years, that's 700,000 housing units we'll be adding. And we can either add them with our codes ramping up between now and 2030 to hit this very high level of performance and then gain the benefit of that ever after, or we cannot. And we've projected here, I mean, the impact is somewhere between the impact of other things that have been debated lately with a lot more fanfare, things like the Clean Fuels Initiative or revisions to the Renewable Portfolio Standard. But it's that level of impact. It's a very major impact. And I'll close by just pointing out one more thing. There's a big negative impact if we wait. There's a lot of building going on right now. There'll be a lot of building going on for the near term. What we've estimated here is that if we wait another 3 years, for instance, before we would take any action on this, then we would have put another 20 million metric tons of carbon into the atmosphere just by waiting another 3 years. Great. So the time is of the essence to get back on track. So thank you very much for your time. And I think bring up Jim Edelson from the New Buildings Institute.
Thank you, Dave. Chair Holvey and members of the committee. Well, I'm not a statistician, but I will provide some of those numbers. My name is Jim Edelson. I am the director of codes and policy at New Buildings Institute, otherwise known as NBI. NBI is a nonprofit. Like Dave, we're actually sharing office space on the third floor in downtown Portland. We are dedicated to advancing commercial building energy efficiency through research, development, design guidance, innovative codes and policies throughout the country and also around the world. I am currently working on energy code in three states other than, Oregon, and I serve on two national code committees, one for the International Energy Code Council and one for the American Society of Refrigeration and American Air Conditioning Engineers, also known as ASHRAE. So I'm going to try and set the context that Dave did with a little more detail, because I last testified to the Oregon legislature on January 16th, 2009, regarding Senate Bill 79. In 2009, SB 79 set in motion the intentions of the state to attain its statutory greenhouse gas goals that were set 3 years earlier, in part with progression of smart and expected regular improvements in energy codes. SB 79 carefully laid out, and I quote from my testimony on that day, a framework for Oregon to achieve energy efficient buildings that is effective in reducing energy use, provides predictability in the long and short runs, and sets forth a path over the next 20 years that will be one of the most important steps to meeting the greenhouse goals that this legislature passed in 2007. Those words are still as true today as they were in 2009. Fortunately, that bill did pass the legislature by wide margin and was signed by Governor Kulongoski into state law. It was embraced by the state agencies at that time. And in fact, in 2011, the Building Codes Division at that time was awarded the one and only nationally sanctioned Building Code Award for excellence in the advancement of building energy codes. This award is called the Jeffrey A. Johnson Award, and it is granted annually by the U.S. Department of Energy in a national presentation. In response to winning this award for energy codes, the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services issued a news release on August 24, 2011. It reads in part, "Oregon has long been recognized as a national leader in energy efficiency. The Oregon Energy Code has consistently been one of the strongest in the nation." What a difference 5 years makes. I'll talk a little bit now with some of those numbers about how Oregon is falling behind. With regards to the National Model Commercial Codes, and I helped write and design a lot of those, as Dave mentioned, the U.S. DOE studies at the Pacific Northwest National Lab have determined that the latest 2015 IECC, which is the model code on which our code is based, would be based, saves an aggregate level of 11.5%. These model codes are updated every 3 years. So there's 11.5% aggregate use in commercial buildings by this code between the 2012 version and the 2015 version. And that presumably would be the basis if Oregon was keeping up with where they're supposed to be keeping up and have historically keeping up or stayed ahead. That's where we would do. That's where they would be. But based on our analysis, that 11% is a very conservative estimate of a shortfall about how far Oregon will be behind the national model standards that under federal statute, the Oregon Department of Energy has to certify its building code levels to the United States Department of Energy. There's really no sanctions if they don't certify or don't meet that level, but they are required to make, and there is correspondence that goes back and forth between the governor's office and the Department of Energy and the U.S. Department of Energy. So they will be at least 11.5% behind when it gets to their next level of certification. To the north, where MBI does considerable work, Washington's legislature has mandated that their codes progress to essentially zero net energy levels by 2031. And that's that handout I gave you that reference to 2031. That's in state statutes. The Washington Department of Commerce, which is their code development agency, is taking their charge seriously. And we estimate that their 2016 code will be 3 to 5% beyond the 2015 IECC I just mentioned, putting it at approximately 15% more efficient than Oregon's code. I have distributed to the committee a summary of the roadmap to 2031 that MBI authored for the state of Washington and was funded by the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance. If you look at the graph on page one, you will see the path of code reductions that Washington code has made and will make to meet this mandate for 2031. Furthermore, the seriousness of this effort in Washington is reflected by the fact that the state statute requires the Washington Department of Commerce to make a biennial report to the legislature about their progress to making the 2031 goal. There is no corresponding requirement in Oregon statutes. That graph on page one was in fact taken from the 2014 report to the legislature. Oregon's SB 79 set essentially the same target, but we are now at least 15% behind that path in relation to the Washington developments. But there is no accountability of the Building Codes Division to the Oregon legislature for progress that has been made as it was in the past or has not been made as is the case currently. To the south, California regulators have ordered goals to be achieved for codes that are essentially net zero for 2020, which is 10 years ahead of that schedule, for residential buildings, and 2030 for commercial buildings. Just as with Washington, there will be at least 15% gaps between Oregon's code and what is called Title 24 version 2016 early next year. So once again, to our north and to our south, and as you know, we are a member of the Pacific Coast Collaborative, which has a goal which parallels this, and the governor Kulongowski, actually it was Governor Kishaber, had signed that, and we are a member of that Pacific Coast Collaborative, and as you can see, we'll be falling far behind our state's commitments to our fellow governors in Oregon, Washington, and the premier of British Columbia. Other states across the country have adopted or will be adopting the 2015 ICC well before Oregon gets around to its next scheduled update. States like New Jersey, yes, Governor Chris Christie himself signed and approved the 2015 ICC for the state of New Jersey over 3 months ago, and it will take effect this year. And states like Illinois and we mentioned Alabama have already adopted the 2015 ICC. Dozens of other states, including Utah, Idaho, Montana, and our neighborhood, will be adopting the 2015 or are planned to adopt it in the year of 2016. But Oregon still has no plans to adopt 2015 ICC. As we were a leader, now we are a laggard. I will say and conclude by saying this is clearly a matter for the legislature. Legislatures across the country have supported the increases in energy codes in their states, as Oregon successfully did in 2009 with SB 79. Oregon has sadly gone from leader to laggard in energy codes, and it is now your job, 7 years after SB 79, to see that we now go from laggard to leader again. If you give the agencies clear instructions to achieve the 2030 goal set by the legislature, just as he recently did for utilities to meet clean energy goals and make them accountable, this will be a huge opportunity, as Dave has mentioned, for Oregon to lead once again and make progress to the greenhouse gas reduction goals you set nearly a decade ago, and we are meeting in the other sectors like power plants and low carbon fuels. Please do not let this pass for another 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. And then I'm really happy that we were able to get a really great builder to come over today on short notice. So we have Mike O'Neill from Solaire, from Bend, Oregon, who is going to share some of his experiences. They've been building some very high quality, high performance homes for years. So.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I'm just going to focus on one small part of this, which is building zero energy homes, which we think has become the pinnacle of energy efficient home building.
Can you introduce yourself, even though he did? You have to do it yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Mike O'Neill. I'm the owner and president of Solaire Home Builders. We are a home builder that builds custom green and sustainable homes, have been doing so since 1995. And
I guess back on track.
Thank you. This is my first time testifying, so I'm new to this. My company and I started this, as I said, in 1995. We started out actually building passive solar homes because we thought that'd be a good niche to start, and it's expanded since then. We became involved with the Super Good Sense program from back in the early 90s, joined with Earth Advantage when they started their program. We've built 4 LEED Platinum homes. We've built a passive home. We've now built 5 zero energy homes. So we think that a zero energy home is really the pinnacle of home building, because on the page 2 of my handout, zero energy home is a home that will produce as much energy on site as it consumes over the period of a year. Real simple explanation if people get confused about what zero means. Building zero energy and zero energy ready homes, the difference being an energy ready home is built all the standards, but it doesn't have the renewable component to it. So we don't have a PV system or solar hot water on it. It's a reasonable and achievable goal for the state of Oregon now and in the future. All the technologies to build a zero energy home are off the shelf. Our local suppliers have the materials, the technologies are readily available, and they're actually commonplace in the industry. All you have to do is figure out a simple way of putting them together, which can be done. We have built 5 zero energy homes in the past 5 years. We have priced them and sold them at market comparable rates. Generally, these homes are costing between 7 to 10% more than a home built to Oregon code. But all of these homes, even back in the first one in 2011, have appraised at or above the asking price. Zero energy homes offer home buyers long-term financial security. They know that no matter what happens to utility rates, and we all know they're going to go up, their rates won't. It will still be close to zero. And I say close to zero because there's always a connection fee, so you don't actually get a zero fee from the power company. In summary, during construction, these homes provide additional jobs to the workforce. They're technical green jobs that pay more, pay higher wages. Zero energy homes will sustain higher appraised values. We've seen that in resales. And again, these homes provide long-term financial security for the homeowners. Building zero energy homes is the right thing to do for the environment and for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Doherty.
Mr. O'Neill, I think you answered my question, and because my concern was, do builders have the technology, the training, and the supplies to build zero energy homes? And I think you answered that.
I think that they need more of an incentive to do it because they tend to go with builders don't go to the next step, but it is
go
there.
With what they know. Yeah.
Right, and especially with Earth Advantage there to help guide, the resources are there. So the materials are there, the resources, even our code is more advanced than most states, so not as far as we want to be, but it's there.
Okay,
does that answer your question?
Uh-huh.
Representative Esquivel.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of sitting here thinking about this, and I'm wondering, both you gentlemen that first were here, you and you, were talking about your 501c3 nonprofit. Where do you get your funding? Because I can't imagine Joe Blow off the street coming in and saying, here's $100, would you please make sure we have zero? I mean, I'm just curious. Where do you get your funding?
Earth Advantage earns 95% of its income by providing services to builders and developers, education, and certification. So the work that to help a builder like Mike figure out the right steps to take, like we actually provide classes that builders pay for, and then we provide certification services, and we go to their houses, and we perform blower door tests on their houses so they can learn where the air is leaking out or where the cold air is leaking in. Mm-hmm. And we actually get paid for those services. In addition to that, we actually do some research projects that get paid for from a variety of services sources about trying to push the envelope to discover, you know, what is the best next steps to take. So then we can turn around and work with the developers and the builders. But that's how 95% of our revenue comes from that. And the other 5% actually comes mostly from product manufacturers who are interested in learning what we know about working with people like Mike, because they don't have that kind of access in the real world. So that's where our funding comes from.
Chair, Representative, New Buildings Institute is a 501c3, and we have a three-part funding structure. The three parts are our foundations, our contracts, such as with USDOE or the Environmental Protection Agency, and sponsorships. And our major sponsors are utility companies. Utility companies have a strong interest in seeing improvement in building codes because the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance is one of our funders. And as building codes improve, this achieves their energy efficiency goals for the utilities, which plays a part in reducing our commitments under something like the Clean Power Plan, et cetera. So it's a three-part structure.
Thank you.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I'm not feeling very good this morning. But, Mr. O'Neill, my question's for you. But first, thank you for coming today and testifying. I deal a lot with general contractors back in my area, Douglas County. Mostly those three contractors I deal with are primarily the most affordable spec building contractors in the community, so I'm quite familiar with what they put together. What is your, not including the lot itself, but a house that you would build to this standard, what is your sale price, price per square foot? What does the customer usually pay?
As a custom home builder, we got a wide range, so it's really hard to pin down. A spec builder builds the same house over and over again, and he knows the cost.
Give me that range then, please.
150 to 200 a square foot.
That's the one issue I have with this is that the force mandate aspect of it, because I don't know about everybody else on the panel, but speaking for myself, I'm obsessive about efficiency. Since I lived in a $300 a month rental, I've been trying to figure out, okay, this thing's blowing air through this old house like crazy. It was built in 1911, so you can imagine it's not very efficient. So I was looking for heaters that would warm my one bedroom as cheaply as possible. When I built the house that I built now by one of those three contractors, I asked him, I said, okay, I'm willing to pay for extra insulation to be put in this if it's going to save me money. And his response was, we're putting so much insulation in these buildings already because of current standards of codes that it'd be just a complete waste of your money. And this is the guy that's selling me something. And I'm saying, here's the money if you think it's going to make logical sense. He said it wouldn't. I think there's plenty of room to make strong, bold new steps into efficiency and within our codes. But what I'm not hearing today and what desperately I think needs to be addressed is cost of living. We just passed a bill, if I'm not mistaken, on regulations involving rent for folks that are struggling to be able to afford to live. Well, somebody had to pay for the building that they now live in. And all the costs that go into construction of those buildings affects the price of rent, whether a lower-end income individual can actually acquire a home. All those things have to be considered, and I'm not really hearing that. I understand that you're ultimately pushing towards efficiency, which can save money in a power bill, but how much money is it saving? And then finally, my final statement is we just passed another bill through House Energy and Environment that will undoubtedly increase the cost of Oregon's ratepayers for electricity. So even though we're going to get gains through construction like this, you're going to lose the cost savings by extra costs and power. So it's really troubling to me that we don't seem to be all that focused on helping Oregonians afford to live in comfortable homes.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Hurd, for that really important question. So as part of, and I'm more so than these gentlemen, I'm more involved in the national code development. And as part of national code development, one of the criteria that the U.S. Department of Energy uses for promulgating the next model code is a cost-effective analysis. And so I just happened to bring here, and I can enter into the record, the cost-effectiveness of ASHRAE standard 90.1 2013 for the state of Utah. This is done for a series of states. Every state can request this, or it is done for every state. And this goes through modeling of the building, the measures that are required to meet the level of 2013 code versus 2010 code, and this would be the equivalent of 2015 code versus the 2012 code used here. For instance, this study is a payback of 1.2 years, and so that is an enormously good investment—a return of over, 50% on your money. So these issues are addressed before the model codes come out, and when Oregon was beyond that, it became more questionable about how effective cost effectiveness is. But for these model codes that the Building Codes Division are ignoring the regular upgrades, those are well demonstrated. I can enter this into the record: the cost effectiveness of that on the national level.
Follow-up. Quick one.
Okay.
And Mr. O'Neill, just so I can finish, I appreciate the service you offer or the product you offer for people. I'm a free market capitalist just like yourself. You're providing a product that, especially in that wealthier community of Bend, people want it. Okay, and that's great, and I applaud you for that. I just don't want to see mandates forcing people down a hole that they maybe can't afford to go down. I hope you have the greatest success going forward. I hope you're building 100 homes a year like this. I truly do. I would never try to get in the way of anything like that. But I have a problem with, and I appreciate 1.2-year rate of return. It's fully paid off. I mean, you can't beat that, certainly not in this stock market right now. But that's not always the case. That's one example.
No, those are sister. systematic studies of the same measures applied in construction markets, and those are similar savings we've seen across the country. And I can provide the additional studies if you're interested. Yeah.
Comment?
Two comments. One, in addition to the study Jim pointed out, in the state of Washington, what their codes committee, one of the first things they said about when they started ramping up their codes was they said we needed to establish how we're going to determine cost effectiveness of the measures. So they followed a separate national standard, but something called the National Institutes of Science and Technology Handbook 135. It's been around for over 20 years as like the standard way of looking at cost effectiveness. And that's what they use in Washington State, and that's what they've used to justify the current code upgrades that they've done, where their residential code will be about 17% tougher than our current residential code, based on a very strict analysis of cost effectiveness, which looks at basically the total cost of home ownership. So it's actually, they will be building homes that are 17% more energy efficient than ours by code, and it will be the least cost housing to live in. It will be less expensive than our housing will be, because the additional construction costs will actually allow for lower utility costs in excess of the amount you would have to loan on. So it will be the lowest cost housing by their code, which is 17% better than ours. And a recent NEA study put out that, you know, 70% of this pathway is already cost effective today if you do that same analysis. So ratcheting up here, that might not have been the case, Representative Hurd, for your builder, because they might not have known the most cost-effective way of adding that insulation to the building. That's what the efforts that go along with when you change a code, you need to educate all the practitioners out there so they know, they can learn from people like Mike what he learned over many years of trying this. And I will point out there were 11 additional letters from industry companies that were filed today. From Neil Kelly, W.H. Hull, Bird's Mouth, Dream Home Building, Allen Contracting, JRA Contracting, Skanska, big commercial contractor, PAE, Sarah Architects, and the City of Portland. And there is one other one that is specifically about the affordable housing. It's Pacific Crest Affordable Housing. They provided a letter here to say they're actually building all the way to the Zero Energy Ready standard as an affordable housing developer, where they actually not only have to build it, they hold on to the property as well and have to be able to rent it at state-approved rates. And for them, and I'll quote, "Our experience has taught us that energy-efficient construction is not only feasible, but beneficial in the long term to a project's financial health. That publicly funded low-income housing developments such as ours are notoriously difficult to develop and operate due to limited development budgets and restricted rental income. Yet they've demonstrated time and again that it can be accomplished within the same or limited budgets." So there you have testimony from someone that is their work, is making sure that there can be affordable housing for people in Oregon. And they believe that this is actually the right path that we should take all affordable projects down that path.
I have one more question from Representative Barreto, and then we're going to move to the next panel while we still have time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. It seems like all of the things have been around energy efficiency, but no specifics. And so the only thing I've really heard is maybe the transfer of air from inside to outside. Is that the primary cause of energy efficiency or lack of efficiency, is the air escaping? And then the other thing would be windows, too, because your windows have, the lowest R value of the construction process. And if you don't improve on the windows, you know, aren't you still going to have that lack of efficiency?
Well, it really is a systems approach. And every change in the code and every change in the above code green building program is looking at what technology is available today that's most cost effective. So right now, you're right, there actually are windows that are cost effective, and current stakeholder discussions with the Home Builder Association over the last several years have said we should probably increase our energy code around windows because the builders are all installing more efficient windows than code requires right now anyway, because that's what's off the shelf from the distributors. So windows have become much more efficient. But when you dig into the details, it's windows, it's walls, it's roofs, it's floors, it's air leakage, it's the leakage from, if you have a central forced air system, from your ductwork. It's about bringing the ductwork from the attic, which is basically outside, inside the envelope of your house and finding the right pathways to make that work. That in and of itself can save 20% of the heat loss from your heating system just by moving your ductwork.
If I could also address that. We look at three things: conservation, reduction in mechanical upgrades, and then production. This is for a zero energy home where it actually has the PV component. When we do a super insulated shell, which is insulation, air tightness, windows, air sealing, that savings that we realize from that portion of the project is 50% of the energy savings. The next percentage of savings is 16% because we're able to reduce the size of the equipment. We don't need a huge heat pump. We can go get with a smaller one. Then the 34%, the big part, is the production of electricity, the PV panels. So for just the conservation and reduction measures gets us to 66% of the savings right there before we even add the PV system. Hopefully that answers your question, sir.
Thanks. We'll hope these gentlemen will stick around, I hope. But I do want to get to the Building Codes Division before they have to leave. And then
actually,
we'll
that's exactly
questions.
Who I have the question for.
So thank you very much. I, you know, probably have a few thoughts of myself, but I'll defer them for right now.
And were you Ethan Nelson from City of Eugene? Did he come up with?
Yes, that's what I was going to do. I don't know if they're, you know, adversarial relationships or not, but I'm sure that you can get along with the Building Codes Division for a few minutes.
Yeah.
If Mark?
They go ahead first.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ethan Nelson. I'm the Intergovernmental Affairs Manager for the City of Eugene, but I also spent 7 years as our Green Building Manager within our Building Permit Services. So I have a little bit of background knowledge on this subject. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on energy efficiency and building codes. The City of Eugene supports statewide high-performance building codes as a means to implement our local climate and energy goals. Due to our state system for model code adoption at the state level, leadership from the Oregon Building Codes Division, BCD, is required to advance high-performance building energy codes. Locally, we have a strong policy framework that provides explicit support to BCD in their efforts to update the energy codes. And I'll go through some of that. In 2014, the Eugene City Council passed a climate recovery ordinance that states, I quote, "By the year 2030, all businesses, individuals, and others living or working in the city collectively shall reduce the total, not per capita, use of fossil fuels by 50% compared to 2010 usage. To accomplish this goal, the Eugene Community Climate and Energy Action Plan directs staff to, one, lobby for adoption of building code amendments that meet the Architecture 2030 standards for energy efficiency, and two, lobby to improve state building codes to encourage the use of passive systems in buildings for heating and cooling systems, lighting, and ventilation. As part of the community land use planning process in Vision Eugene, which is in our local community, an estimated population increase of roughly 35,000 people will occur in the next 20 years, forecasting a need of an additional 15,000 homes, and those are split about a 60-40% between single-family and multifamily. To meet this increased population need, To address the climate and energy aspects of our projected growth, the Envision Eugene actions include, number one, make energy efficiency in buildings and vehicles the first line of action in reducing energy dependence and greenhouse gas emissions. Zero energy ready buildings, or net zero energy, however you want to call them, are already being constructed across the state, and a similar code pathway is being implemented in our West Coast neighbors, Washington and California. The changes happening in the design and construction industries are moving toward the future, and they need ongoing state and local support for the financial investment required to make zero-energy buildings the norm in our communities. Thank you for your consideration. That was it.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing the issue forward. It's interesting. And we're going to hear from the Building Codes Division about building codes, energy efficiency, and where the state of Oregon is.
Terrible right now. Oh. Wait, don't stay away from me if you're sick. Go away.
I got that.
Oh,
I
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. I'll be passing around a document. This is our annual report, and you'll find that talking about building codes sometimes isn't the most exciting subject. And so I thought what I'd do is give you just a little bit of background about our organization and what we do, and this is the best document that provides that. For those of you that may be new to the organization, I'll just let you look at it. This is an annual report we provide to the legislature. It talks about the various things we're going on, the health of the economy, which I've heard talked about that, the activity level on the construction employment side, construction permitting regulation side, and some of the issues impacting the overall industry. More importantly, you get a sense of what we do. And so one of the things we do is adopt statewide building codes, but we also provide inspector training and evaluation. We do dispute resolution through appeals. We provide a series of regulatory relief valves for our customers so that they can come to us for emerging technologies, to alternate methods, to custom inspection plan review services. And then we provide licensing and enforcement of our subcontractors, our electricians, plumbers, folks who work in the boiler areas. We oversee local government, and then there's a variety of value-added services we provide. And you can see all that on the second page of my document. In the interest of time, because I do have a board meeting today where we're going to be adopting energy codes, interestingly enough, I just talk a little bit about what we do and kind of our integrated system. The first thing that you should know is the building code system, as I just laid it out, it's unlike any system here in Oregon and the rest of the country. So when you hear comparisons to other states, keep in mind that what we do here is quite a bit different than our neighbors to the north and the south. When we adopt codes here, they actually get implemented in the field. They're followed through by the inspector training programs, our oversight of local government, and there's a preemption of local government from adopting different standards. Many times states will adopt standards, and then locals can choose to opt in or out, so you really don't see the outcomes that they advertise being done in the field, and we think that's very important. As far as codes go, we adopt 13 codes. We call them specialty codes. They break down into electrical, plumbing, structural, which is on the commercial side, residential. I'm going to leave somebody out, I'm sure, but boiler, plumbing, recreational vehicle, amusement rides, etc. They're developed by five national organizations, and so you'll hear acronyms like IECC and all those. We use codes from five main bodies to cover those 13 different craft areas. And so they're adopted in Oregon on a 6- and 3-year cycle where we do major code changes every 6 years and we do adjustments every 3 years. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, quite quickly, we have the ability to deal with new technology and emerging issues such as high-rise wood buildings, which we're working on right now, in the interim as relief valves. So Oregon has a very unique system that's quite a bit different than the other states. We adopt our codes through boards. We have 7 boards here in Oregon. They're broken down by the industry sectors: commercial, residential, mechanical, boiler, electrical, plumbing, and an energy board, believe it or not. In 2009, as a matter of fact, this body, this committee, adopted legislation to create the energy board that's made up of contractors, suppliers, building trades, Department of Energy, designers, utilities, local government, and public members. The goal was to create an area where you can address comprehensively all the energy issues across those crafts so that if you did something in one area, it didn't affect another area. But because, again, in Oregon, it has to work, and we have to make sure that it gets carried out for our contractors, whether we're building standard houses in Douglas County or custom houses in Central Oregon or whatever the mix is around the state. And if I didn't clarify that, the standards that we set are the same around the state. It not only provides business predictability, but you also get equal protection from consumers, and then, you get the assurances that it gets done from community to community. Our process to adopt codes is fairly simple. We send out a notice 90 days before the start. We let folks know what our goals are, whether they're on the energy side or on the seismic side or building side or plumbing or electrical side, what we're trying to get accomplished, what are some of the issues going on. Then there's a 45-day public submittal process where any member of the public can submit and request changes of the code, and we receive those based on a set of criteria that we have. And then our boards, depending on what type of code change we get, our boards will establish a technical committee to review the substantive nature of those code proposals, and then the board will review that work itself, similar to your work here at the legislature. Both the committee work and the board level work is public. The public can participate. And the one thing that we do that's quite different than everybody else is we video stream those meetings. You'll be able to see the meeting this morning if you'd like, so that the public can see what's going on. Once the board decides what it wants to do, to accept or reject a code proposal, modify it, get the contractors and all the stakeholders together, then we go to public hearing. In building codes, we actually have a two-step process for public input through boards and committees, like you're familiar with many agencies, and then we go into rulemaking, and there's additional time for the public to come in and suggest changes or modifications to whatever the codes are. Once all that's done, then the agency weighs in. I tell folks I vote last. We make sure we get the input of our customers. We see what's going on. We kind of up front set out the standards that we're looking for, and then we either adopt or reject the proposals as they come forward. Once we're done with that, we try to get all that work. Then we go into printing, having five national code organizations. You got to get codes printed. The books are quite thick. You wouldn't believe the back and forth we go through getting the printing correct and making sure we don't have errors. And then what we try to do is get all that done 90 days before we anticipate adoption so that our inspectors, our contractors and subcontractors, designers, architects, engineers can all be trained up on what the latest standards are, whether it's energy or anything else. That takes about 18 months to kind of navigate that process, just generally speaking. I know it sounds like a long time, but there's upfront time for public participation, there's technical review, and then again, we want to have adequate notice so that the system works, because you're going to hear something repetitive from me. What we do in Oregon gets done in the field, and that's quite a bit different than the other states. Once the codes are adopted, then we have to execute them. So there's training. We train the contractors. We train the journeymen, the inspectors, and the design professionals. We hear appeals and disputes about various issues. We provide requests for interpretations, and then we enforce the codes. So that's kind of the execution side. For customers who may not like the standard codes, we have choices. Some people use the word a reach code. I like to talk about mandatory requirements versus voluntary requirements. It's much easier to communicate. We'll set a standards, mandatory requirements, you have to do this. And then we adopt what's called voluntary requirements, which is, again, what we're doing this morning, so that if builders want to use the latest and greatest technical standards on energy efficiency or seismic or general construction, that they can do that. Today we'll be adopting I don't want to get it in front of my board. Presumably we'll be adopting the 2015 IECC, which is the latest energy standard for the work on commercial. And then, as I mentioned, we have emerging technology for products that come in that may not be recognized within the various codes or national standards. And then, of course, we provide state review for custom areas. I guess the one thing that I do want to mention, our focus is consumer protection for folks who use buildings. Consumer protections has two sides to it. We want to protect consumers from harm, but we also protect consumers from unnecessary costs. So, Representative Hurd, we also have to do a cost analysis for residential construction in Oregon. It's a specific additional finding that when you make changes to residential construction, you have to analyze the impact. I think it's a 1,200 square foot building, standard building, mm-hmm. and analyze the impact of all the code changes, whether it's energy, structural, seismic, et cetera. And then we have to make those findings before we go forward. We make sure that we're very sensitive to duplication of effort and redundancies in regulations, either between our organization, local government. Got a lot of conflict sometimes between the fire service and what we do on the commercial side. We're trying to clean up some of those things. I think the chair's aware of some of that. And then we make sure that on the private side that folks who may want to advocate for special certifications or special licenses or additional costs to consumers, that we make sure that if we can, we fold that into the normal regulatory environment. So for many of the things that you hear, our probably biggest disagreement with folks is we think many of the inspections and verification processes, your ducts testing and your sealing things, should be done by the building inspectors that you're already paying for as a consumer and not through some kind of special additional requirement. And we find that that's the biggest tension point in the energy space that we have. I can talk to you about the schedule when we'll be changing codes, but we redid all of our codes for a minor adjustment in 2014. We've got our electrical and plumbing on schedule for 2017, our residential code for 2018, and our commercial code for 2019. And then we'll start all over again. And remember, just because I say it's 2019, we'll start that process roughly 18 to 24 months before so that you can get through the public process. So that's kind of the status of codes. We can quibble about what people believe where Oregon's at. Just so that you know, after we adopt a code, we have our findings reviewed by research institutions. We don't use a lot of things out in kind of the marketplace because we find that the assumptions, the outcomes, and the numbers can kind of vary from individual to individual. So as an example, when we adopted the most recent commercial code on the energy side, we had the University of Idaho, which has a relationship with the U.S. Department of Energy, review our findings to make sure we're in alignment with national standards. Going forward, we'll be using the University of Oregon because that professor at University of Idaho is now at the University of Oregon. And we find using the institutions and universities provides kind of an objective test of what we're doing here in Oregon to make sure that when I need to certify, Department of Energy doesn't do it, we do it. When we need to certify our building code to the U.S. Department of Energy, I have actual facts I can use to say we're in alignment based on university research. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions that you have. And I'm watching the clock because I do need to leave.
Representative Widener.
Quick. I actually just built an Energy Star certified home here a couple of years ago. And thing I ran into, and I don't know if this has been addressed or not, but it changed. So like you're getting ready to adopt new codes right now, I start building right now and I'm going off the old codes, the new ones come in. So I didn't pay and have somebody come in, pay the $750 or whatever it was for the inspection because I knew I was behind the new codes that just came in. Mm-hmm. Is there a way you could allow people to get a certification from this time? It was Energy Star certified for 2005 to 2006. Is this anything that's been discussed in your meetings at all?
Representative,
it is an issue.
Not at all. There's two issues. There are many incentive programs that builders can work through and consumers can work through. On the code side, and I'm not sure of their timing and how all that works, and of course we would prefer, if the legislature is to take action, is to really get incentives aligned with the codes. There's debate that the code should align with incentives. We actually think that the code should dictate the standard because they're based on national codes. You have national training programs for the contractors, for the workers, for the inspectors, for the designers, and you line up that, and then you make your incentives line up with the bump up in codes, and so that's more consistent for the contractor. But that's not the way the system works currently. On the building code side, what we do is, if you're an application during that 90-day period I talked about where we know what we're going to do, but it's not in effect yet, we kind of let you either use the new one or use the existing one. And we generally give the builders a grace period, even 90 days after it goes into effect, if you have an application in process. Because one of the things that's pretty important to us, notwithstanding energy issues, is that we don't change the rules on our customers. We have kind of a policy, and actually it's cemented in statute, just so that you know you're talking about codes. This isn't an energy issue. In Oregon, our policy is once you build your house or commercial building and you get certificate of occupancy and you use it in the way that it was intended, and that's a clear part, and you don't modify it, the government doesn't come in and change the regulations after the fact and force you to upgrade or change the standards.
Grandfather.
So you have buildings that are existing that have been around for some time, and as long as they don't change the use from the original approval, we don't come in and we work very hard to make sure the fire service doesn't come in and change the rules on you after the fact. So I don't know if that answers your question. When you're dealing with incentives, I think those can change based upon
what it came down to was getting the incentive, and yeah. It wasn't worth the tax incentive to have the guy come out and do it.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, have you heard this program outlined before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel.
We just have.
Yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of different things in my time at Building Codes, and I think that all of you have had me testify in front of you on a variety of different things. I'll just tell you this. Here are the things we watch out for, okay, not react to anything specific. We try to make sure there aren't misaligned incentives, that that product manufacturers or special interests aren't aligning with certain code proposal groups to kind of put forward their preferences at the cost of somebody else. So we really watch for those issues. That happens quite a bit, unfortunately, in the code system. I wish it didn't. It didn't for many years. It has the last 10 years, and we really have to watch it. It's pretty prevalent in the energy space, but it happens in the other areas as well. So watch for that. Again, we look for the additional costs that are put in on special certification requirements. And then in the energy area, we look to see what folks are doing, because a lot of times you'll hear the word zero energy or this or that and the other, and a lot of it relies on renewables to meet the standards, and we think that you should have your house perform fairly well on the conservation side, and if you choose to use renewables to get to your zero energy or whatever you want to call it, then that's fine. But we do see situations where there are preferences for renewables versus conservation, preferences for house sizes, small disincentives to build larger. We're very careful about those kinds of issues that we see occurring nationally through some of these programs. And here in Oregon, we make sure, again, that the system works across the board. I've got to make sure that what the boiler folks are doing on their boilers, what the plumbers are doing on their side, the electricians, the commercial builders, and the residential builders, it all kind of lines together. Because, again, here in Oregon, what we do actually gets done out in the field, and we have better outcomes than many of the other states for actual work that's done in compliance with the standards, both on the safety side and on the energy side in the field. So I'll answer your question, but that's what we look for.
Other questions, Mr. Long? Well, thank you.
You
appreciate you being here.
Mr. Chair, if you guys have a chance, I mean, this is, I know it's just purely in the propaganda thing, but this is a document put together. It gives you a pretty good background. Again, it's hard to talk about building codes. It's not easy, and so hopefully this kind of lays out kind of what we do and how we look at things on an annual basis. Okay?
One quick question.
You bet.
When you're considering energy efficiency and things, mm-hmm. I know that, you know, my experience was building construction is in a previous century. So
it's
changed
a little bit,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yeah. So I understand. But do you take, is there any sort of, you know, when you're coming up with new codes and, you know, your boards are reviewing the codes, do they take into consideration other elements? Because I always think back when they first decided that they needed, you know, to prevent air leakage, they decided it was a smart idea to put Visqueen all around the inside of the house, which, you know, was a good idea, except that they didn't really follow up with, you know, the proper airflow, and we subsequently had, you know, mold and rot and indoor air that was not healthy, all in the name of, you know, this energy efficiency model, because I spent a lot of time fixing places and ripping drywall off where the Visqueen was basically creating moisture.
Sure.
and causing a lot more problems and a lot more expensive problems than the savings realized by that. I mean, did the building codes learn anything from that?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. We are, considerably more careful and make sure that we get that broad-based input when dealing with products or these kind of new technologies. I'll just share just a side story. You may have heard about the fire over in Dubai and down in Las Vegas on the outside of those hotels and large buildings, and some of that had to do with some of the energy material that was put onto the outside of that building caught on fire. So again, probably a good idea for one thing and a bad idea for another thing. So we've learned through LP siding, the Construction Claims Task Force, some product issues, how to be very careful. And that's really where your help with creating the Energy Board in 2009, and frankly the Speaker's reaffirmation of that board in 2013, when she helped us modify it a little bit to get everybody at the table to make sure that we're deliberative when we're looking at changing the code, so that we don't have some of those things that you talked about. So We do now, Mr. Chair.
But I would assume that you still your long-term goal is to, you know, pursue more energy-efficient
absolutely,
structures.
Mr. Chair. We'll have to, we have to identify, as folks mentioned, Senate Bill 79, we have to identify the goals that we have for the next cycle. And so one of the goals, just off the top, on the residential side, is we've got to bump up by 3 to 5% in our next upgrade. So we'll set that standard, then we'll wait for the public to suggest how we might do that. We'll wait for the boards to review that work, and then we'll kind of weigh in to see if we think we met the goal, and then we'll have that goal. We'll have that, if, once we adopt, we'll have that reviewed by our institutions to make sure that we indeed did it. So then I can certify to USDOE that we're in compliance.
Thank you. Okay. I know you're about 5 minutes beyond your comfort zone, so
yep.
I'll let you go.
You. I'll be running out of here.
And I don't know if any of the other testifiers wanted to come back up and, you know, provide some final comments, or whether we have any more questions for some of the other panelists.
Yeah, Mr. Long left, but Jim Edelson, New Buildings Institute. One of the issues that Mr. Long brought up was this uniformity of the code within the state of Oregon, and it's what's referred to as a max-min code, meaning cities can't adopt energy codes are more efficient or less efficient than the state code, but and he characterized that as a benefit. But in California and Washington, which you referred to, that is actually the opposite case. And this is one thing I think the legislature should look at in 2017. If you look at both the Eugene Climate Action Plan and the City of Portland Climate Action Plan, the number one issue, since greenhouse gas emissions are more than 50% attributable to buildings, they are not able to increase their building codes. And Mark said he's going to raise the code 3 or 4%. You look at the graph I sent you, they have to raise it 10 to 15% to be on track. And that's what City of Portland wants to do. They want to raise their building code. So their number one climate action plan in the building sector is to work with the state to increase the building codes. And they are not legally permitted to have a more efficient building code than the state. Whereas in San Francisco, they have CalGreen. In the city of Seattle, they have a homegrown code. So there are reasons to have an additional efficiency code available for those cities that want that have policies to achieve that. That is a huge issue for the local governments in the city in the state of Oregon.
So that sounds like an interesting topic to continue a conversation about. Because what I was hearing from Mr. Long was that they were allowing voluntary, I suppose, code enhancements as opposed to mandating
right.
them.
Right. That's within their code structure. That's the way their code is structured. But the city of Portland or the city of Eugene or the city of Hood River cannot have
mandate
a minimum base code, what we call the base code.
So that's the issue where a local government can't mandate something higher than what the state is.
Chair Holvey, to that issue, the Administrator Long spoke about the REACH code, which was authorized under SB 79, and City of Eugene, working with BCD and ODO in the past couple of years, we've tried to actually advance use of the REACH code because we saw this as a great opportunity to be able to get high-performance code at a cost-effective, high-performance building as a cost-effective manner so that we wouldn't need to, and not to disparage my colleagues from Earth Advantage, but go outside to a market-based system and just continue to use the existing regulatory system whereby you have to have inspections. You have to come on in. You have to drop off your plans. They have to get reviewed and inspected and be able to get a higher performance in that same process via the REACH code. What we found was that builders, there was no market potential, there was no understanding in the market of, regarding a REACH code house. So you'd say, oh, we built to the REACH code. Somebody that can't turn that around and sell that and have a price premium that would allow for that increased cost to the builder, to the homeowner. And so roughly, I think there's a handful of projects across the state that in the past 5 years have been built to that higher REACH code standard. And so while it's great in theory, what we found is that it hasn't been practical. And so what we come back to is how do we continue to have
more higher performance codes that are the base code that become the standard. And so that's what we ask of the legislature.
Thanks. That helps clear up the conversation a little bit for me. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of wondering here, couldn't the city of Eugene, like, take the highest level of code and use that, or offer, the city could offer an incentive to a builder, say, hey, this is what we want built in our city, and we'll do the inspections free and the certification for free for you, and you just build all ENERGY STAR certified homes. Can you do things like that? Do you have that creative capability?
Yeah, Chair Holby and Representative Widener. Yes, and we do. And yet there's a delta in regards to how much incentive that we could provide via our, you know, our municipal budgets, and that, you know, it pales in comparison to the actual square footage and the number of units that are being produced on just the standard code basis. And so while we do have a number of high-performance incentive-based programs to provide process incentives and maybe some utility rebates with EWEB, what we find is that when you create the base as the high-performance, then you start to shift the market, and so that it becomes more cost-effective because everybody starts to do it, much like what you talked about with, Representative Barrett was speaking about increasing the R value in windows. When that market shift happens, then you get the cost of efficiency.
Thank you. Do you have something else to add?
Yeah, Chair and Representative. But yeah, being partially responsible for the Texans SB 79, and with regards to the REACH code in Oregon, that is one potential shortcoming of that language. I've worked with REACH codes, or what are called stretch codes, in the state of Massachusetts, the state of New York, the state of California, and because of the way the REACH code is structured in the Oregon statute, it cannot be used as a mandatory minimum code by Eugene, and it cannot get that broad stat. And we work with utility incentives can be tied to that. We worked with National Grid, we worked with Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, we've worked with Efficiency Vermont in Vermont, we've written a stretch code in Vermont, I'm doing it for NYSERDA now in New York. There is a real ability to target incentives to a REACH code that a city like Eugene or Portland or Hood River could adopt. So I think that's another improvement that could be made in the SB 79 language as a way to address that maximum limitation currently in there.
So do you know about any of the energy efficiency of the new cross-laminated panels that were spoken of earlier? Some people in the back.
I'll just speak from a national perspective. I'm on ASHRAE 189.1, and we look at it's the green building code for the nation, and we are looking at products like that, and we will cite innovations like that, and the green building code. We want to talk more about the.
Chair Holvey.
I opened up a new topic, I guess.
Well, Representative
Helm opened it up, actually.
You know, new technology, it always draws me like a moth to a flame. But we'll likely be working on that project as the verifiers of the energy efficiency elements and the certifiers of it. And so it does offer an opportunity for commercial buildings, specifically with the wood panel construction, to the building material itself will inherently have higher R values than the typical commercial building structure would, you know, compared to concrete or even the typical construction where you have an empty wall and a layer of insulation on the outside. The wood panels in and of themselves will offer, you know, R1 per inch, and you're talking about relatively thick panels for a 14 story building. So it does offer some exciting opportunities that you get structure and insulative value all in one building material.
And just a final question about your organization. So does your organization actually do on-site inspections that are recognized by the building codes?
The work that we do here in Oregon is not recognized by the building code officials. It's for third-party certification bodies such as U.S. Green Building Council, okay, our own standard, EPA's ENERGY STAR standard. I believe there is interest from the Oregon Home Builder Association, and actually I've heard there's interest from the Oregon code officials that they would like to see flexibility in that organizations like ours and other organizations that do third-party verification of above-code energy measures, that they would like to... Both of those organizations have an interest in allowing those inspections to stand in the stead of some code official work. So there, I believe there will be some proposals coming to the codes division this year regarding that.
Great. Thank you. Seeing any other questions, Representative Helm, do you want to close for us? I know you just weren't waiting around here for...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks a lot for all your good questions today and your interest. Just to wrap this up, I wanted to, since this is the business committee as well, there's a ripple effect that goes along with ooching the market along in the direction of energy efficiency, and there are market opportunities that can grow out of it. So I thought I'd give you just a couple of examples. So our high efficiency homes, they need certain building materials. Not everybody would want triple paned windows, for example, but for those that do, we're still importing those from Europe. Okay, there is a building material that's used to insulate moisture barrier these new homes. That's essentially, my understanding is, it's sawdust and paraffin wax composed in a certain way. That's imported from Spain.
Carpenter ants respond to that.
Oh, yeah. They love it.
Slide ask.
I'll stay with Tyvek.
Yeah. Well, Tyvek goes, I think, is a partner material with this stuff. A third thing is, in some of our higher-end passive homes, the heat exchangers that are super high efficiency, that essentially require, the use of them makes it so that the building doesn't need a furnace or a heat pump. You just... You use the heat of human beings living in the home to heat the home. The heat exchangers that are used in those homes are all manufactured in Germany, and we have to import them too. So if we are capable of creating an environment here where we're promoting this type of business and we're ooching it along through our codes, we have the opportunity to develop those businesses here and export those products to other states from our own state. I didn't want to leave the committee with the idea that this is all just stick. This is all just regulation. But there's carrots involved too, and there's opportunities for our business community to take advantage of in this home manufacturing process. Thanks again.
Thank you. I appreciate the closing with the big picture. Not seeing any other questions, thank you very much for an interesting presentation, and we'll maybe have some more discussions about it. With that, thank you very much, committee. We are not scheduled to meet on Friday, so, you know, sleep in. And I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. On Business and Labor. I'll adjourn the House Committee.